Hey guys, if you missed out on the last conference in Nashville, Tennessee, you don't want to miss out on the next one. It's April 28th through May 3rd, Orlando, Florida, the Gaylord Palms Resort and Convention Center. You made a mistake missing the last one. You don't want that to happen again on this one. 5 days of some of the best training you're ever going to experience packed into one event. We have an early bird special right now, $50 off. Use 24 early bird on our website, streetcop.com. Look for the conference, click the link, register today. If you want to get significantly better at this profession in 5 days, don't dare miss out on the 2024 Street Cop Conference. 111,
Street cop. So what the Constitution is, it's the law that governs those who govern us. Statutory law, that's the law that governs private citizens. Common law, that's what governs private citizens. What is, constitutes a crime, what, that's the law that governs the citizen.
The juvenile's attorney claims his constitutional and Miranda rights were violated and that the July arrest was illegal.
You have the right to remain silent and refuse to answer any questions.
My dad is an attorney.
Anything you say may be used against you in a court of law. As we discuss this matter, you have the right to stop answering my questions at any time you deserve. You have the right to a lawyer before speaking to me, to remain silent until you talk to him, to have him present while you're being questioned.
Probably the most over-the-top introduction for a police legal instructor in the history of law enforcement. But I truly appreciate it. Thanks to all of you all. Congratulations to all of you all who've made it to day five here. I see we've lost a few, but congratulations on being here. It's been a great week. We've had some great speakers. Some really passionate folks have been up here. I mean, Kenny and Brad, passionate about, you know, high-level criminal interdiction. Tom Rizzo, passionate about development, leadership development. Dennis, passionate about passenger-side approaches and using profanity to express his beliefs and thoughts. So I'm passionate too. Passionate about constitutional law. That's a little anticlimactic, even coming from me, but. This topic is really important. It's the foundation of everything. It sets the foundation for everything that we're doing, that we talked about all week. If the stop is not lawful, it doesn't matter what we find in the car or how much money we pulled out of this stop. If we fail to read a Miranda warning at the proper time, some testimonial evidence could certainly be suppressed. So. Let's see how much constitutional law we can cover in the next hour or so. I'm sure all of you know or recognize, if you've been in this profession for, you know, a day or two, there's quite a bit of misinformation floating around amongst our departments and our prosecutor's office, even our judges, about what the law is, like what we can and can't do. And a lot of that misinformation is based on misunderstanding of case law. And that, to me, that inhibits effective investigation. And it can also certainly lead to some other negative consequences. If we misunderstand the law, we misapply the law, there's certainly evidence exclusion issues that we could face. There's criminal liability, civil liability, and again, not to mention inhibiting effective investigation. One example that I will give you is Miranda warnings. If I were to poll this group here, and I've done this informal poll in everywhere that I've taught over the years, and I don't think the result would be any different here. If I were to ask you all an A or B multiple choice question, A, do we under-Mirandize people as a profession? So just nationwide, do we under-Mirandize people? And that means, are we reading Miranda, are we not reading Miranda nearly as often as the law requires us, causing statements to be suppressed? Or B, do we over-Mirandize people, meaning we're reading Miranda much more frequently than the law requires? And I think the answer would be, I know the answer is B. We over-Mirandize people. I call these Miranda gift bags. Okay? The complimentary Miranda warning. All right? I'm not a fan of the Miranda gift bag. I think you gotta earn it. You gotta do something to find yourself in custody, first of all, and then be subjected to police interrogation. Why do we over-Mirandize people? Why are we constantly handing out these free Miranda warnings? Well, I think the answer is simple, is we don't have a firm grasp on what the law says about when it's actually required. And we know very well that failing to give a Miranda warning when it's required could certainly lead to incriminating testimonial evidence being suppressed, valuable evidence in our cases. So as a means of CYA, okay, we're going to go ahead and drop a Miranda warning on this guy before we ask him some questions. Now, that doesn't create legal problems for us. There may be one particular outlier of a situation where I could argue that may be a legal issue, but for the most part, it's not a legal problem. We're not running afoul of the law when we give the Miranda gift bag the complimentary Miranda warning. But my contention is that the complimentary Miranda warning inhibits effective investigation. Think about it. I got this guy sitting in front of me, and I'm getting ready to ask him some questions. I'm thinking that I probably would like him to answer my questions. Okay. The last thing that I would want to have to do is remind him, you don't have to talk to me, which is what Miranda's all about. So you never have to talk to the police. What Miranda, the Miranda versus Arizona case tells us is there's certain situations when the police are obligated to remind you that you don't have to talk to us. And even there's the bonus, you get a lawyer, a free lawyer, if you want, to kind of guide you through this interrogation. If I don't have to do that, I would prefer not to, because that's counter-purposeful to what I'm trying to accomplish, which is him to answer my questions. Now, there certainly are situations where it's required. If he's in custody, if he's under arrest, or being restrained to the degree normally associated with formal arrest, that's the test for Miranda custody. A person is either under arrest, or a reasonable person would feel as though he's being restrained to the degree normally associated with formal arrest. If that is not our circumstance, then I'm not obligated to give a Miranda warning. I would contend that some people who are given the complimentary Miranda warning, some of those people are going to say, well, hey, you know what, that's a good idea. Thanks for reminding me of that, officer. Yeah, I'm not going to answer any of your questions. Okay. Some people will invoke their right to remain silent. And my further contention is that some of those people who invoked their right to remain silent would have talked to you had you not reminded them that they were not obligated to do so. That's why, I mean, it inhibits effective investigation. It potentially closes down an avenue of investigative technique that would have been available to us had we not thrown out or handed out this complimentary Miranda warning. I know some of your patrol cars, the trunks are just full of these gift bags. We're just handing them out like candy. I would urge everyone instead to take a little bit of time and study what the law really says. And that's my job, is to help you to understand that. So let's move into what we're going to talk about today. First, a note that I want to make, I'm going to talk about the federal constitution today, the Fourth Amendment and the Fifth Amendment particularly. Every state has its own state constitution, and each within those state constitutions, there is an analog to the Fourth Amendment. There's a search and seizure provision of every state constitution. And most state constitutions have some form of a self-incrimination clause as well in their constitution. So the thing to remember is we're going to be talking today about the baseline level of protection afforded to citizens of the United States. So the federal constitution establishes the minimum degree of privacy protection, liberty protection that are afforded by the Constitution, that come from the federal Constitution. No state officer, no federal officer can abridge those rights. It's the minimum. Now, some states afford greater protections to their citizens under their state constitutions. And we'll talk about a couple of those examples as we move through the day today. Many of you know, or if you work in those particular states, you're well aware of some of these. But a lot of states, most states, in fact, their courts have held, their state courts have held, that their search and seizure analog of their state constitution is, it mirrors the protections of the Fourth Amendment. Okay, my home state, Virginia, is one of those. Okay, the Virginia state constitution offers no additional search and seizure protections outside of the Fourth Amendment. So having a solid understanding of the Fourth Amendment is the way forward in every single state. One thing, though, I do want to mention before we move into the substance of the material is if you're someone who likes to keep up to date on case law or do research and try to educate yourself, which I absolutely encourage everyone to do, is to at least stay abreast of the current cases. And then the big cases, the ones that, you know, every police officer should know a little bit about, Terry versus Ohio, the stop and frisk case. The big three, Terry versus Ohio, Miranda versus Arizona, and Graham versus Connor, in my opinion, are the big three constitutional cases. Those are cases that if you hear those names as a police officer, your reaction should not be one of puzzlement, like you've never heard that before. Other cases, you know, we can get away with not saying we've ever heard of that case. But if you tell someone, I'm a police officer, no, I never heard of Terry versus Ohio, can you tell me a little bit more about that? Yeah, that's not going to go over very well. You want to pay attention to your state cases, obviously. Your state Supreme Court and appellate courts, however they're structured in your state, you want to keep abreast of those decisions. But you also want to pay particular attention to the Federal Circuit Courts of Appeals. The vast majority of our constitutional law is actually developed in the Federal Courts of Appeals. It's not the U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court hears, on average today, about 60 or 70 cases a year. Of those 60 or 70, there may be 5 or 6 that deal with something criminal procedure related. And maybe of those, a couple of them may be Fourth Amendment cases. We've had years where there have been no Fourth Amendment cases. And the most recent years, the Fourth Amendment cases really haven't been anything too exciting coming from the Supreme Court. But your courts of appeals, your federal circuit courts of appeals, are the federal courts that hear the vast majority of our Fourth Amendment cases. So we want to pay particular attention to those, and especially the circuit, the numerical circuit that you're geographically located in. So for example, New Jersey here, you're in the Third Circuit Federal Court of Appeals. You would do well to remember, though, that these decisions, these circuit court decisions of the federal system, they're not binding on state courts when it comes to matters of constitutional law. Your state court is free to contradict a ruling of your federal circuit court of appeals on facts similar before them. But the trend, the tendency, though, is in reality, state courts give high deference to the federal circuit in which they're in. So if you are keeping up to date with Third Circuit case law, for example, in New Jersey and Pennsylvania, then you have a good guidepost about how these issues would likely be resolved in your state courts if they haven't already done so. The exclusionary rule, I'm sure all of us are certainly aware of it. This is the mechanism by which Fourth Amendment rights are most frequently enforced. It's not through civil lawsuits. It's certainly not through criminal cases. It is through the exclusionary rule, the application of the exclusionary rule. A defendant has made a motion to suppress in a pretrial hearing to determine whether evidence was obtained in violation of the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment exclusionary rule is a judicially created exclusionary rule. There's nothing in the text of the Fourth Amendment that suggests evidence must be suppressed when it's obtained in violation of the Fourth Amendment. The Supreme Court created the exclusionary rule in a case called United States versus Weeks back in 1917, I believe was the year, 14 or 17. Versus the Fifth Amendment, there is a Fifth Amendment exclusionary rule as well. So for Miranda violations, for example, the Fifth Amendment exclusionary rule would kick in. That is explicit in the text of the Fifth Amendment. We'll start with the basics, and it may seem overly basic, but it's the threshold point in our analysis. The Fourth Amendment protects against unreasonable what? Searches and seizures. So if I have to understand what the Fourth Amendment allows me as a police officer to do, I first have to understand, well, what is a search and what is a seizure? Because if it's not a search or if it's not a seizure, guess what does not apply to this situation? The Fourth Amendment. Okay? So what is a search? This is the harder of the two to define. Seizure, not so much. But with a search, there are actually two definitions or two parts of the definition. Each one of them by itself would be a search. And most of us are familiar with the traditional definition of a search. This comes from Katz versus the United States. This is the telephone booth case. Those for the younger folks in here, that's a telephone booth. Okay, I know probably a whole bunch of you have never actually seen one of those in real life. You would actually go inside there, close the door, drop a coin in there, and make a phone call. Long before the advent of cell phones. There certainly are. It's been a long time since I've actually seen a freestanding phone booth, even today. But they were a thing back in the 60s. It got us this case, Katz versus the United States. This involved the federal government attaching a recording device to the exterior of a public telephone booth to record a conversation, or at least half of a conversation, in which Mr. Katz was involved. The Supreme Court gave us, in this case, the modern, or the traditional, I should say, definition of a search. It's the one that all of us know very well. An intrusion upon a reasonable expectation of privacy. So if whatever it is that we're doing intrudes upon a reasonable expectation of privacy, that's a search. If I were to walk up to somebody's car and open the trunk and start rummaging through it as a police officer, would I be intruding upon an expectation of privacy? Absolutely. Do you have an expectation of privacy in your vehicle? Yes, you do. We'll find out later that it's a reduced expectation of privacy compared to other areas like your home or your person, but it's nonetheless an intrusion upon a reasonable expectation of privacy. So that's a search. Now we would go into, well, what makes a search reasonable? The existence of probable cause, plus either an exigency or a warrant or consent, one of those other factors. Okay? But the threshold matters, is it a search? Versus if I'm walking down the street in a neighborhood and there's a bunch of cars parked on the sidewalk and I'm just shining my flashlight inside, looking inside the cars as I walk by as a police officer, am I intruding upon a reasonable expectation of privacy? And the answer is no. There's no reasonable expectation of privacy one could have. It would not be reasonable for one to expect someone wouldn't just walk by and look inside of their vehicle. So that's not a search for me to shine my flashlight inside of a parked car. Unoccupied, occupied, it doesn't matter. Since it's not a search, does it have to be reasonable? No. I don't need probable cause. I don't need reasonable suspicion. I don't need warrant. I don't need any kind of suspicion. It's just simply not governed by the Fourth Amendment. A few years ago, about 10 years ago, the Supreme Court has added a second definition to the definition of a search. This is the physical trespass definition. I call it the Jones test or the Jones definition. And this is where there is a physical intrusion upon a constitutionally protected area with the intent to gather information. What are constitutionally protected areas? Well, we refer to the text of the Fourth Amendment. It protects four particular and distinct areas. Your person, your house, which is also includes your curtilage, your person's house papers, and your effects. Effects is kind of a collect-all category for all private property that would not be deemed a paper or real property like your house. So your car, for example, is an effect. So that's a constitutionally protected area. This is the GPS case. This is the case where the court held that when the officers physically, they attached a GPS device to the undercarriage of Mr. Jones's car. This was up in Maryland, where this Maryland, D.C. area. That act of putting the GPS device on the car was a physical trespass. They went back to the common law definition of trespass to chattels. Is physically touching somebody else's property could be deemed a trespass. And why was the GPS put on there? To gather information about Mr. Jones's travels. Okay, so it was a search. It was arguably not an intrusion upon an expectation of privacy. You don't really have an expectation of privacy in the undercarriage of your car, so that cat's definition wouldn't necessarily work well in this situation. But the physical trespass test does. Most of the time, though, when we have a search situation going on, it fits neatly into both of these definitions. This is usually a distinction that doesn't really matter in most cases. When you search a car, when you've pulled over a car and you've got probable cause to search a car for narcotics or other contraband, it's both a physical trespass with intent to gather information, intrusion upon a reasonable expectation of privacy. The Jardines case came out right after Jones, and this applied. This was an interesting one. This is for the canine handlers in here. Bringing a dog, a drug detection canine, onto residential curtilage is a search. The act of bringing the dog on the residential curtilage is a search. Okay, so since it's a search and we're talking curtilage, which is an extension of the home, that means I need either probable cause plus a warrant or some kind of exigency or express consent. This implied consent that allows us to walk on like the walkway up to the front door, that's an implied consent that allows me, the officer, to do that. But I can't bring my drug detection canine onto this residential curtilage without a warrant or express consent. So it's a search to bring the dog onto the property. They applied the Jones physical trespass test to this case. This may not apply to those of you who work in urban areas, but a lot of you work in rural areas. Private property beyond the curtilage. So the curtilage is essentially the area immediately surrounding the home. Most frequently, we would think of that as the yard. That is a constitutionally protected area. That's an extension of the home. It receives almost the same level of protection, that heightened level of protection that the home enjoys. But areas beyond the curtilage, private property, private real property beyond the curtilage, the legal term for that would be an open field or woods. Interestingly, that does not receive Fourth Amendment protection, period. It is not a search for a police officer to enter a cornfield, for example, for whatever reason. It's not an intrusion upon a reasonable expectation of privacy, and it's not a physical trespass. It's not a constitutionally protected area. So I don't need, if I have a tip that they're growing marijuana in a state where it's still illegal to do that, in the middle of a cornfield, and I want to go investigate as a police officer, an anonymous tip, something that I don't even have, it doesn't even rise to the level of reasonable suspicion. I can go on to that that private property, that cornfield, it's somebody's private property, and investigate, look for this particular marijuana grow operation without implicating the Fourth Amendment at all. I don't need probable cause. I don't need reasonable suspicion. I don't need consent, warrant, exigency. I don't need any of those things. It's not protected by the Fourth Amendment. So a lot of folks are not aware of that. And the Supreme Court's made that clear in one of the oldest Fourth Amendment cases, Hester. And they reaffirmed it again in the early 80s with Oliver. Not a search to enter onto an open field or woods, land, private property beyond the residential curtilage. What about a seizure? What's a seizure? The concept of whether we've seized a particular person is a lot easier to grasp than some of these search theories. A seizure is, most of us know this, it is a situation where a reasonable person would feel as though he's not free to leave or not free to decline the encounter. A reasonable person would feel as though he's not free to leave, okay? At least not without any legal repercussions, okay? If a reasonable person would feel like they were not free to leave in this particular situation, then we have seized that person. I want to focus on a key word, our key phrase that I used in that definition, a reasonable person. The Fourth Amendment is always evaluated objectively, as opposed to subjectively. Objectively means it doesn't matter whether the particular guy, we're in a motion to suppress, and the defendant is arguing he was illegally seized, okay? It doesn't matter what he felt. If the defendant takes the stand and testifies about how he felt about that situation, I didn't feel like I was free to leave. I didn't feel like I could just walk away. Your prosecutor should be objecting. That's not the right standard. It doesn't matter what he thinks. Also doesn't matter what the police officer thinks. It matters what would a reasonable person in the defendant's situation, how would they evaluate this circumstance. Okay, so they're always evaluated objectively. We know that from use of force. Okay, use of force has to be what kind of reasonable? Objectively reasonable. Would a reasonable officer react the same way, use the same type of force to the degree that this particular officer did? That's the standard for use of force, when we apply force to somebody, we're implicating the Fourth Amendment. Okay, so it's always evaluated objectively. So is Miranda custody, by the way. Always objective. Doesn't matter whether our particular potential interrogee felt like he was free to leave, or he was under arrest, or he was restrained to the degree normally associated with arrest. For example, I know some of you, especially in the back, it's kind of hard to see, but there's a guy sitting there on that planter right there, surrounded by about a half a platoon of police officers. Objectively, without knowing anything else about the situation, would it be reasonable to think that a person in that situation would feel like he can't just get up and walk away? He's been seized. He's being seized by a show of authority. A bunch of armed, uniformed police officers, not saying anything right here, not applying any physical force. That would be a seizure by submission to show of authority. Anytime the red and blue lights come on, that signals to someone you must stop. Okay, you're not free to just continue driving on. So one of the quintessential indicators of a seizure is when the red and blue lights come on. There could be circumstances where we could argue that a reasonable person may not feel free to leave, but at least at the initial outset of this stop situation, a reasonable person would feel like they couldn't just drive away when they see those red and blue lights. A key, though, with seizure by show of authority is, though, there has to be a submission to that show of authority. Hadari D is an interesting case. Officers get into, they see a young man, Mr. Hadari, and he takes off running upon the sight of the officers. The officers give chase, shouting, "Stop, police!" And he argues, Hadari argues, ultimately, because they found drugs on him, that seizure, he was illegally seized when the officer started yelling at him and ordering him to stop. He's arguing the officer did not have reasonable suspicion to detain him. And the Supreme Court said, well, you didn't stop. You didn't submit to their authority. That yes, the officers told you to stop. They were attempting to seize you, but you didn't submit to their show of authority. You continued running. Therefore, no seizure. No seizure until you actually submit to that show of authority. Now, unfortunately for Mr. Hadari D here, when he was running, he reaches into his pocket and tosses some drugs out to the side that the officer saw. So whether or not the officer had reasonable suspicion at the outset of this pursuit, we clearly had reasonable suspicion, if not probable cause, by the time the officers caught up to him and applied physical force to him. This is one situation, this failing to submit to show of authority. This is one area where some states deviate. Some states do hold that under the state constitution, a mere show of authority is a seizure. And if I'm not mistaken, and I certainly could on this one, Pennsylvania is one such state. Dan Foster could certainly correct me on that. But I believe under Pennsylvania's state constitution, the mere show of authority, so that pursuit would have been a seizure under the state constitution at the time the officers initiated it, that therefore requiring at least reasonable suspicion. The other way we can seize someone is by applying physical force, not the force, capital F, lowercase f, force, the application of physical force with the intent to restrain the person. We had an interesting case that came out earlier this year. It was a case where officers actually shot the suspect in this case, and she ended up driving away. She was in a vehicle. They shot at the vehicle. They hit her, and she drove away. And she argued that she was illegally seized when they shot her. They eventually caught her sometime later, but there was a long period in between the actually getting hit and getting arrested. I believe she got arrested at the hospital. She argued that the seizure was illegal. At the time they shot her, the government made a novel argument. Well, she never submitted to the show of authority. We're not disputing we shot her, but we are saying that there was no submission, that shooting didn't cause her to stop. She kept on driving. Therefore, applying that rationale from Hadari D, there was no seizure. The Supreme Court ultimately said no. When you apply physical force to someone with the intent to restrain them, such as shooting them, then that's a seizure at that moment. Now she broke free. The seizure ended as soon as she drove away, but the initial application of physical force with the intent to restrain is definitely a seizure. One of my favorite slides is this one, and if you were a bunch of police recruits, we'd probably spend about at least a half a day going over this. Most officer-citizen contacts fall into one of these three categories here. The only state that adds a fourth category is New York State. They add an additional category prior to voluntary contact. And if I'm not mistaken, and Ken Rice can correct me on this, but it's a mere inquiry, I believe is the term. I could be slightly off on what that terminology is, but it's an additional category of contact even before the voluntary contact. That's the only state that I've ever seen that has that fourth level. But for everybody else, under the Fourth Amendment, there are three categories. And it would always behoove the officer involved to know which category we're operating in. There are different rules, there are different requirements, there are different things we can do depending on what category we're in. We need to know at all times. We need to be prepared to answer the question, am I free to leave, officer? Well, if this is a category two, an investigative stop, the answer is no, you're not free to leave. Arrest, clearly you're not free to leave. Am I being detained? Well, which category are we in? And I'm not going to go into all the details, but everything up here, you can see just a couple of points. You can see them that under the voluntary contact, that's a zero. That signifies zero factual justification. I don't have to justify legally. I don't have to have a legal reason why I'm initiating a voluntary contact under the Fourth Amendment. I can talk to anybody that I want to for any particular reason. They're free to decline to participate and go about their way. Over the last year or so, I've started to add a fourth category, but it's more of a subcategory, and it's kind of hard to see, especially in the back, but I'm calling it the 2A. First of all, these 1, 2, 3s up here, they don't have any legal significance. You would never testify in court. Your Honor, this was clearly a 2. I don't know why we're even having this discussion. It's a 2. I don't know what the defense attorney's trying to call us a 3. It's a 2. Now, these are just up here for ease of discussion. I've added 2A, vehicle stop passenger, because as we'll see when I get to the portion of the presentation on vehicle stops, passengers are clearly not free to leave on traffic stops. Under the Fourth Amendment, a passenger is not free to leave on a traffic stop. But they're not normally the target of the traffic stop. They're just being seized by virtue of their unfortunate circumstance of being in a vehicle where the driver committed a traffic infraction. But that's really the extent of our involvement with our authority over the passenger at that particular point. They can't just walk away. But I don't have reasonable suspicion directed to them, so that's why I created a separate category for those. There's another category that's kind of an outlier that I don't have represented up here. Many of your states do checkpoints. Clearly, when you physically enter that checkpoint, wherever the physical beginning of this checkpoint is, that's clearly a seizure. You're not free to just drive on through, okay, or turn around and drive out, okay? You're clearly seized. But we absolutely don't have reasonable suspicion at this point, much less probable cause. So that's an outlier category. But most of our contacts are going to fall into these categories. The Miranda gift bags are most frequently handed out. Category two. That's a true statement up there on the board. Most investigative stops do not require Miranda warnings, okay? Including traffic stops, most traffic stops. Why? Because they lack that custodial or arrest-like circumstance. Let's talk about searching people. We're just kind of hit some highlights and see how far we can get. Searching people, stop and frisk. I like to ask this question, is stop and frisk lawful? This term stop and frisk over the last several years, it's taken on kind of a negative or it has a pejorative association with it, certainly for political reasons. The NYPD about 10 or so years ago got into some pretty significant issues in a federal court with their stop and frisk practices. And you hear this term bandied about, stop and frisk is unconstitutional. Well, I would ask, what makes it unconstitutional? Is it lawful? And yes, it's lawful when we do it lawfully. That's a lawyer answer for you. Yes, but, you know, always have to add a condition to that. When we do it lawfully. Well, what makes stop and frisk lawful? Well, we already covered the stop part of stop and frisk. That's a lawful detention. You got to have a lawful detention of the person. Frisk, I call it a frisk, but pat down is synonymous with frisk, whatever term you like to use. Pat down means the same thing. Pat frisk, that's unique to the Northeast. I've never heard a pat down or a frisk referred to as a pat frisk in any place other than the Northeast. But they all mean the same thing. It's a protective search for weapons. And I did say it's a search. If you're asked by a supervisor or a prosecutor or an attorney, did you search this particular person after you've conducted a pat-down? Many officers have been taught to say, no, I didn't search him. I just frisked him or I just patted him down. A pat-down is a search. A frisk is a search. It's a special kind of search, though. See, that was one of the key points in Terry versus Ohio. The first question that the Supreme Court had to address in Terry versus Ohio was, is a frisk even governed by the Fourth Amendment? And the first holding in Terry was that a frisk is a search. It is governed by the Fourth Amendment. See, stop and frisk was occurring long before Terry versus Ohio. It wasn't until 1968 where the Supreme Court finally decided to address, is this in or outside the bounds of the Fourth Amendment? And it is. A frisk is a search. What's the definition of a search? An intrusion upon a reasonable expectation of privacy. If someone walked up to you and just started patting you down, touching the exterior of your clothing, would you find that to be intrusive? Absolutely. Okay, whether we go with the Jones physical trespass test or the Katz reasonable expectation of privacy test, it's a search. It's a special kind of search. Okay, so a frisk is a search. It's a protective search as opposed to a full search. Full searches require probable cause. Full searches are searches for evidence or contraband. What is a frisk a search for? It's a search for weapons. That's why it's a protective search. There's other protective searches too. There's protective sweeps of homes. There's frisks of cars. But a frisk is most certainly a search. Another question officers frequently answer, not incorrectly, but incompletely, why did you pat down my client? Or why did you pat down this particular person? Maybe your supervisor's asking, reading your incident report. Why did you pat him down? What do a lot of officers say? For officer safety. Okay, that's an incomplete answer. I hope it's correct legally, but it's incomplete. Safety is the reason why we're allowed to do frisks in the first place, but there's a rule. And the rule, what justifies a frisk, and I'm talking about a non-consensual frisk here, everyone. I'm not talking about the, hey, do you have any weapons on you? Do you mind if I pat you down real quick just to make sure for my safety and yours? That's a consensual frisk. I don't need reasonable suspicion of anything to ask that and perform that frisk. I'm talking about, with this rule here, the involuntary frisk. The whether you like it or not, I'm patting you down. Okay, what's the rule? Well, the first rule, the first element is you got to have a lawful stop. So I've got to have at least reasonable suspicion to believe a person involved in unlawful activity or that they're a passenger in a traffic stop. And what's the second reasonable suspicion? Not everyone who is being detained lawfully is subject to a non-consensual pat-down. I've got to have reasonable suspicion to believe they're armed and dangerous. Armed and dangerous. I'm going to come back to that point in just a second. So not everyone that we stop, do we have this reasonable suspicion, this second level of reasonable suspicion. Now, I've got a firearm up there. Okay, but it's any kind of weapon. Any kind of weapon that I might suspect the person has, I could frisk them for it. And, of course, the key to the frisk is not only is to discover the weapon, but also to be able to take the weapon. Pay attention to that reasonable suspicion, that second one. Watch this. See how I got real small? Courts don't require a whole lot for that second reasonable suspicion. See, reasonable suspicion is already a low standard on the continuum of justification. It's towards the end, towards the bottom. The reasonable suspicion that I need to justify a belief that they have a weapon is minimal. Courts generally, they don't require a whole lot of suspicion factors to believe someone's armed. Okay. Let me go back to this armed and dangerous aspect. Okay, so there's kind of a split in the courts as to what this means. What does armed and dangerous mean? That's the term they used in Terry versus Ohio. There are two ways to interpret that. So we're looking at Dwight here. We're looking at that gun he's got right there. Let's say I have him lawfully detained. Pick your favorite infraction to detain someone for. Okay, he's detained. I see that gun that he has right there. I don't just have reasonable suspicion that he's armed right now. I know he's armed because I can see it. So can I disarm him? So I would go back to the rule. R has to believe he's armed and dangerous. So there's two ways that courts look at this armed and dangerous. One way is the unitary armed and dangerous. It's more of kind of a term of art. Armed is therefore dangerous. That's one interpretation of armed and dangerous. Armed is therefore dangerous. And as long as I've got RS to believe he's armed, I can pat him down and remove that weapon. That's one way of thinking. Robinson, the Fourth Circuit case right here, is the leading case that takes that view. Okay, so if you're in the Fourth Circuit, this is a case out of West Virginia, by the way. That's the prevailing view in the Fourth Circuit. Armed is therefore dangerous. We could disarm Dwight in our scenario. It doesn't matter why we have him detained. I see that he has a weapon. A firearm in this case, that's armed is therefore dangerous. Now, I will note that in Robinson, and I believe this is the correct analysis, is that armed with a firearm is therefore dangerous. The holding in Robinson was armed with a firearm is therefore dangerous. The legality of the possession of the firearm is not relevant for Fourth Amendment purposes, according to Robinson. A person lawfully carrying a firearm is potentially just as dangerous on an investigator or a forcible stop as someone who's unlawfully carrying it. For purposes of that brief seizure of that weapon, armed with the firearm is good enough for the Fourth Amendment, according to Robinson. The opposing view is that armed and dangerous is a bifurcated analysis. We've got to do both analysis. We have to do the reasonable suspicion to believe he's armed. I got that. And then reasonable suspicion to think he may actually attack me with that weapon. He presents an actual threat to me or to society or maybe even to himself. Okay. Armed and dangerous are separate inquiries. That's what Toledo here, Northrop versus Toledo, that's the leading case that takes that view. Okay, Sixth Circuit case. That's Ohio, Michigan, and I believe Kentucky, I think, is also in there. So which one is it? Well, so the Supreme Court would have to resolve this issue. We've got a circuit split. The exact same issue has come before two courts. One says one thing, one says the other. We would probably need to know an answer. It's not likely, though, that this is a case that the Supreme Court's going to take. If you ask for my opinion, for whatever it's worth to you, I think Robinson's correct. Okay? If you read Terry versus Ohio, and the way that they use armed and dangerous is kind of more of a term of art. And then the follow-up case, the next stop and frisk case that came after Robinson is a case called Adams versus Williams from 1971. They used the term armed and dangerous there. This guy was armed with a firearm. There were no facts presented in Williams that suggested this guy was a threat with the firearm, and the court upheld that frisk. I think armed and dangerous, the unitary analysis is the correct interpretation of what that phrase means. But other courts, people far smarter than I, disagree. And we'll just kind of have to see where that goes. I don't think it's something the Supreme Court's going to be taking anytime soon. Search incident to arrest. I want to mention this because there's been a really recent development, a trend that's been showing up in the federal courts of appeals that we need to be aware of with search incident to arrest. This is one area of Fourth Amendment law that has undergone a significant degree of readjustment or recalibration, I call it, since 2009. 2009 is when Arizona versus Gant came out, and since Gant massively changed how we do search incident to arrest with vehicles, but it's starting to have trickle-down application to other areas. Search incident to arrest when it comes to a person. If I make a custodial arrest, we all know this. He's getting ready to go to jail or some detention or booking facility. Doesn't matter why he's under arrest. Full search of his person every single time. No additional justification. Search incident to arrest, the arrest is the justification for the search. Searches require probable cause. Full searches require probable cause. What's my probable cause? The probable cause to arrest him. It's essentially a free search of his person. The arrest justifies the search. I don't have to have any reason to think he's got any weapons on him or any reason to believe that he has evidence or contraband. The arrest justifies the search. That's an easy one. The person, that hasn't changed, and that's not going to change. Robinson makes that clear. It's a categorical rule. Where the change is occurring is with these carried belongings, backpacks, purses, luggage like Sheldon is holding up there. And they can be traced back to Chamel versus California. This is the modern search incident to arrest case. Chamel is the modern search incident to arrest case. Search incident to arrest is justified under two purposes. One, to ensure the person has no weapons on them. They're getting ready to be taken into custody and transported away. We want to make sure they have no weapons on them or in an area that they could access to attack the officers or effect an escape. And the other justification for search incident to arrest is to make sure there's no evidence, accessible evidence, that the person could destroy. Well, when it comes to their person is always accessible. Okay, so that's why that's a categorical rule. Well, what about carried belongings? We make an arrest, and the guy is wearing a backpack, okay? And at some point, he's going to put the backpack down. Maybe we order him to, you're under arrest, drop the backpack. He drops it, or he drops it on his own. Maybe it falls off his shoulder. I'm not talking about he's running from us, takes the backpack, and just tosses it aside. And we're going to argue that's an abandoned property issue. That's not the same thing. We're talking about he's given up, he's surrendered, and we're either taking the backpack off ourselves or it's just laying nearby. He's arrested, he's handcuffed, we're going to do our search of his person, okay? Now we have this backpack. We just kind of took it for granted, and it's because courts did as well, without any really thought, that backpack gets searched too. He was carrying it. Either at the time of or right before we arrested him, it's still in his immediate area, you get to search, and the courts allowed us to search that backpack as an incident to the arrest, an extension of the arrest, okay? No particular reason to think there's anything in that the backpack's not supposed to be there. Since Gant, though, and this Davis case is the most recent one, again, a Fourth Circuit case, but this is now the fourth federal court of appeals that has held that backpack cannot be searched under search incident to arrest theory. I know the Ninth Circuit has held so, the Tenth Circuit, and if I'm not mistaken, the Seventh is the other one. Actually, I know it's the Seventh. And now the Fourth Circuit has held that once the arrestee is secured, a carried belonging is generally no longer immediately accessible to that person. See, the key with search incident to arrest is the item has to be immediately accessible to the arrestee, not at the time that he was arrested, but at the time we're choosing to search the item. So when someone is handcuffed with their hands behind their back, they've been searched, we got an officer or two guarding them, maybe we're on the side of the road, we've now got them in the back of a car. That backpack that he was carrying is no longer immediately accessible. Therefore, it is not subject to search incident to arrest. It would take some significant gymnastic effort on the part of that suspect to break free and quickly access that bag to gain a weapon or destroy evidence. And what the courts are doing is they're applying the first prong of Gantt, and we'll get to Gantt shortly. Gantt talks about vehicles not being subject to search when the arrestee is secured and doesn't have access to the vehicle. When an arrestee is secured properly, following proper police procedure, that backpack is no longer accessible to him. So search incident to arrest, that free search, is now starting to be questioned. Now, I didn't say we can't search that backpack. I never once said you can't search that backpack. I just said that we can't rely on the old easy standby search incident to arrest. In Davis, they chased this guy into the woods. He got stuck in some mud. He had a backpack on him. He surrendered, comes out, drops the backpack on order from the police officer. He gets handcuffed, and the officer reaches down and searches the backpack. Well, the guy's handcuffed and being guarded by a police officer, found a bunch of drugs in there. The court held that that was not a valid search incident to arrest. That backpack was no longer accessible to him. Yeah, it was laying right next to him, but at the time they searched it, it wasn't immediately accessible. So under search incident to arrest theory, we don't get to search it. However, in Davis, this is going to now get sent back down to the trial court for a new trial, because the trial court denied his motion to suppress and the drugs were admitted. He was convicted of the drug possession case. So now it's got to go back down to the district court for a new trial, understanding that's not a search incident to arrest. The prosecution is going to have to come up with another justification for that search. And they have a nice, easy one at their disposal here. He's in the middle of the woods. He was in a vehicle by himself, okay? There's nobody else on scene. We're not leaving that backpack in the middle of the woods. What are we going to be doing with that backpack? It's coming with us and him to the jail. We can inventory items that we lawfully take into custody when we're going to be taking that item with the person to the jail. We can do inventory searches of items. Most jails, all jails, should have an inventory policy. Whenever you bring an arrestee into a detention facility, they're gonna search the arrestee. They're not going to rely on your field search of the person. And then you bring in carried items, they're going to search those items as well. Illinois versus Lafayette tells us that's a lawful thing. We're allowed to inventory these items to make sure we're taking custody of this backpack. He's going to be we're going to send him off to a cell somewhere. It's in our custody, much like when we tow a car. We want to account for the items that are in the bag. So when we give it back to him, when he gets released, he has a receipt of what was with him when he came in. And of course, if we discover contraband along the way, we can take that. Well, the inventory search is going to be occurring at the jail. This is an inevitable search. There's no reason a police officer cannot do that inventory search in the field. So in Davis, we could have justified that search as an inventory search because that backpack is going with him to the jail. Okay. So I just want everyone to be mindful. This is the trend in the federal courts of appeals. I haven't seen any state courts yet on this issue, but I haven't really spent any time looking for them. I guarantee they're out there. This is the trajectory of search incident to arrest. We don't get to rely on that anymore as the free search when we're talking about carried belongings. It either has to be immediately accessible to the arrestee at the time we're searching it, which is not going to be a frequent occurrence, or we're going to need some additional justification. An inventory search. If I've got probable cause to believe that backpack has contraband in it or something else that's not supposed to be in there, then I can search it, but what am I going to need? I'm probably going to need a search warrant for that. There's no exigency or consent. Okay, so I can still take it into custody if I've got probable cause to believe it's got contraband in it. Everyone, I think, hopefully knows this. Electronic devices are not within the bounds of search incident to arrest. California versus Raleigh makes that clear. You arrest someone, they got a cell phone in their pocket. You can't just open it up and start scrolling through it, reading text messages, opening apps, and things like that. We used to be able to do that. Numerous courts had allowed searches of electronic devices as an extension of the search incident to arrest, including in the Fourth Circuit, where Virginia is, where I'm from. We searched cell phones all of the time, pre-Riley, and of course you can just imagine, we found all kinds of evidence that we had no idea was even in there. We got this free search of the phone. Supreme Court says, yeah, no, that's a little bit beyond what we meant or what we intended in 1973 when we decided Robinson. The last thing I'll note about search incident to arrest, just a point that there has to be a custodial arrest. No custodial arrest, no search incident to arrest. There is no search incident to summons or citation. All right, let's talk about vehicle stops and searches, since that's what most of our discussion over this week has dealt with vehicle stops. First of all, everyone knows this. Reasonable suspicion is the minimum standard for a vehicle stop. You don't need probable cause, at least under the Fourth Amendment. RS is the only requirement. Supreme Court has said that numerous times. Hine is just the most recent case. What is a pretextual stop? A pretextual stop is a dual-purpose stop. It's a stop that has two components. It has a subjective component and an objective component. For example, we got a car that runs a stop sign, but we just saw this car come out of a neighborhood known for frequent drug dealing, which that's not going to be reasonable suspicion by itself. So I want to stop this car to see if I got any drugs in there. I get this hunch that there's drugs involved, so I'm going to look for a minor traffic infraction to stop the vehicle. Is that lawful? Of course it's lawful. When we do it lawfully. Okay, Wren versus the United States makes it clear that pretextual stops are lawful. Now there are some rules that we got to follow on pretextual stops, and I want to talk about Rodriguez. This is one of the most frequently litigated cases today in the courts of appeals, and also in your state appellate courts, are these Rodriguez issues. Rodriguez tells us, and I don't have time to get into the facts, it's kind of an interesting case, but what the holding in Rodriguez tells us is that when we're on a traffic stop, we have to be focusing our questioning and our other actions, whatever investigative steps that we're taking, have to be focused on two missions on every traffic stop. There's at least two missions on every traffic stop. One, the first mission is to address the legal reason for the stop. The legal reason for the stop is the violation that we've observed. Okay, so this is a traffic infraction stop. Mission one is addressing why you didn't stop at the stop sign. Did you know, why is your tail light out? How long has it been out? Those kinds of things. Why are you speeding? The other mission that is attendant in every traffic stop is our safety-related concerns, ensuring that we conduct this traffic stop in a reasonably safe manner. Everything that we're doing investigatively has to be addressing each of those missions, because anything that we do on a traffic stop that goes beyond the mission or missions of the stop in this case, that adds time. This is the key to Rodriguez. Anything that adds time to the stop violates the Fourth Amendment. Anything that adds time, and I should say, is that's not supported by reasonable suspicion. Okay. So, for example, I pull over a car for speeding, and I ask a whole bunch of questions. Where are you coming? Well, let's tick off a few questions. Where are you coming from? Where are you going to? Itinerary questions. Would that be, could we argue that's within the mission of either of the components of the stop? Yeah, courts have consistently held simple, where are you coming from, where are you going to, itinerary questions are permissible as part of the routine mission of a traffic stop. Are there any weapons in the vehicle? That's addressing a safety concern. Courts generally allow, are there weapons in the vehicle? Is there anything illegal in the vehicle? Now we're approaching the realm of unrelated to the mission of the stop. When I ask that question, is there anything illegal in the vehicle, I'm adding time to the stop. It takes time to ask that question. Yes, we're measuring this now. We're getting down to seconds. But that's where we are. These are how these things are being litigated. Is there anything illegal in the vehicle? That's adding time to the stop. Some courts have disallowed that question. They have held that is not related to the stop, mission of the stop. Therefore, it's unless it's supported by reasonable suspicion to believe there's something illegal in the vehicle, that's going to violate the Fourth Amendment. Now, what if I've got a second officer on scene, and I'm going back to my car to run all the IDs and everything, and my partner, instead of standing back at the window by my car, just wasting time, BSing with me, he walks up to the driver and starts asking him a whole bunch of questions. Are any of those questions adding time to the stop while I'm back in my car diligently pursuing the traffic matter? The answer is no. Those are completely permissible under the Fourth Amendment. Okay, some states do not allow those questions under state law. I know Oregon is one of them. Washington, I believe, is another. Okay, but they're outliers for many reasons. Those questions are completely permissible under the Fourth Amendment because of what am I not doing? I'm not adding time to the stop. Unrelated questioning is the term that I use, is completely lawful as long as we're not adding time to the stop. There's that natural, if I'm by myself, there's that natural lull when I call in the driver's information. Okay, I'm waiting for dispatch to get back. And nothing I do during that time frame is adding time to the stop because this is a natural lull in the stop. Can I search your car? Do I have your permission to search your car? Or however we're phrasing this consent to search. Related to the mission, courts say absolutely not. That is not related to one of the two missions for the stop. Searching someone's car on a speeding stop in no way furthers why they're speeding. Okay, and unless I believe there's a weapon in there, it's not going to address the safety concern. And once I believe there's a weapon in there, I don't even need to ask. Okay. So can I get consent to search your car? Three ways valid consent can occur on a traffic stop. One, ask it without adding time to the stop. My partner, again, up there while I'm back in the car diligently pursuing the traffic matter, he or she asked for consent to search the car. They're not adding time to the stop by asking that question. A lawfully detained person can give consent. I don't know where that misconception comes from, that if someone's detained, they can't give consent. That's absolutely false. United States versus Watson makes that abundantly clear. That was an arrestee who gave valid consent to search. 1976, United States versus Watson. So one, ask for consent without adding time to the stop. Two, develop reasonable suspicion that there's criminal activity occurring, where consent would lead to potential discovery of evidence. Okay, so if I walk up there and I develop my reasonable suspicion that there's criminal activity involved in this vehicle, now my mission has greatly expanded. I can address that reasonable suspicion, and consent to search certainly would further that mission. And the third way is to end the stop. Finish the traffic stop, conclude the traffic stop, make it clear to a reasonable person, this stop is over. Here are all of your documents back. Here's your warning. Here's your ticket, whatever it is. I always like to drop in the, hey, you're free to go, or this, we're done with this traffic stop. It's concluded. You're free to go. The Supreme Court says we don't even have to tell them that. Can't think of a good reason not to say that, though, if I'm trying to prove my next interaction with this person is voluntary. Okay? But end the stop. Make it apparent to a reasonable person this stop is over. Then ask, hey, before you drive away, would you mind staying around and answering a few questions? I just have a few questions I want to ask you. Would you mind hanging out just for a second? Sure, officer, go ahead and ask your questions. Now I can ask whatever I want. Okay. So three ways consent. And it can be the same thing with a dog. See, I've heard many people say, well, Rodriguez says we can never run dogs around cars again. That's not what he said, without reasonable suspicion. That's not what it said. Because Rodriguez was a dog sniff case. What Rodriguez says is you can't run the dog by adding time to this. You can't use the dog running or walking around the car as adding time to the stop. You develop your reasonable suspicion. You do it without adding time. That's completely lawful. And under the Fourth Amendment, I don't need reasonable suspicion to walk a dog around a lawfully stopped vehicle. Okay. Illinois versus Cabalas right here makes that abundantly clear. It's not a search to walk a dog in an area the dog's allowed to be. Okay, because all he's doing is smelling the air. There's no expectation of privacy in the odors emanating from your vehicle. Who's required to identify themselves on a traffic stop? Well, if it's a traffic infraction stop, every state has some statute that says a driver is obligated to identify himself. Passengers are under no legal obligation to identify themselves. You have to have at least reasonable suspicion under the Fourth Amendment. It doesn't matter if you have a statute that says this in your state. Because if you apply that statute, you could be applying it unconstitutionally. You have to have at least reasonable suspicion to believe someone's involved in illegal activity to demand their ID. Now, I can ask anyone. But to demand the ID from the passenger, give me your identification, that requires at least reasonable suspicion. Okay? Heibel makes that abundantly clear. Okay? Only the driver is... this is not a traffic stop case. It's a stop and identify statute that was being reviewed by the Supreme Court. Real quickly, you can order people out of the car. No reason required. Okay, under the Fourth Amendment, now some states do require some kind of, heightened caution in New Jersey. Other states require at least reasonable suspicion. But under the Fourth Amendment, I can order the driver to exit the car. I don't have to have a particular reason why. Same with the passengers. If I want the driver and or the passengers to exit the vehicle, I have the lawful authority to order them out. I don't have to have a legal reason why I want them out. And I mentioned this in my slide with the three categories of officer citizen contacts. Passengers are not free to leave under the Fourth Amendment. Some states do not allow officers to detain passengers outside that initial pulling over and making sure everything's okay, and then they're free to go. Oregon, again, is one of them. Washington, I think, also. But not under the Fourth Amendment. The vast majority of states, you have the authority to order everyone to stay in the car. I want to cover vehicle searches, and that'll probably get me to the end of my time. I could go on for hours, but we just don't have that time. Car searches, very simple rule. Warrants are very rarely required. Now, I am not anti-search warrant. I am not opposed to search warrants. Okay, there are many times search warrants are required, and they should be. But when it comes to cars, the law under the Fourth Amendment, it's abundantly clear. It's not required. Okay, in most circumstances. Most circumstances, you encounter vehicles that you want to search, and you have the proper justification for them. They just are not going to require warrants because there's so many exceptions to the warrant requirement. I mean, the law, it couldn't be more settled. I'm not a fan of getting search warrants that I don't have to have. That's taking my time. I'm a busy person. And whose job am I making easier by getting the search warrant? Potentially the prosecutor, okay? But let me just say, and I say this to prosecutors all the time, and when I speak to them, someone always says, well, I hope you have time to come for a motion to suppress then, to justify your warrantless search. I say, you know what, I'll make time for that on the off chance that actually happens. On the off chance there actually is a motion to suppress. Because the case law is clear. See, your job as the prosecutor is to argue the case law before the judge. And the judge, your trial court judges, are obligated to follow the case law. It doesn't matter what their opinion of it is. When the Supreme Court says you don't need a warrant, and we're deciding this case under the Fourth Amendment, the answer has already been made. The answer to the question is already made for the judge. The prosecutor's got to argue the case law, and the case law is clear. Okay, so I'll take the risk. I'll go to a motion to suppress that I don't, on the off chance that that's required, versus wasting my time to get a search warrant. However, it is never wrong to get a search warrant. You cannot be wrong by getting a search warrant. If you have policies that require it, then follow your policies. See, I'm just talking about what the law is in here. I don't set policy for your agencies. I'm here to tell you what the law is, and then hopefully your agency understands the law and then sets their policy in accordance with the law. There could be good policy reasons why we don't want officers doing warrantless searches on vehicles that have no exigency associated with them, for example. That's fine. That's for you to decide, for your agency to decide. I'm just telling you the law doesn't require it. Okay? The vehicle frisk is one category of warrantless search. This is the wingspan search. Okay, we're going to talk about search incident to arrest momentarily. That's not a wingspan search. I hear officers all the time say, when we make an arrest out of the vehicle, you can do a wingspan search of the car incident to arrest. That's not a wingspan. No, that's a different thing. Search incident to arrest is a different kind of search. The wingspan search is your vehicle frisk. Your vehicle frisk. This is your protective search. When you've got a lawfully stopped vehicle and you have reasonable suspicion to believe there is a dangerous offender who has access to a weapon, immediate access to a weapon, I should say, then we can frisk those areas that are immediately accessible to that person, the lunge area, if you will. We're going to order the person out of the vehicle, and then we're going to go inside the vehicle and search through those areas that would be immediately accessible. So, for example, let's say I've got a driver, sole single occupant driver. What are areas that would be immediately accessible to the driver? Unlocked glove box, unlocked center console, map pockets in the door, pockets behind the car, behind the seat, on the back seat, under the seats. We're looking in those areas for weapons because I've got reasonable suspicion to believe there is actually a weapon in the vehicle. That's your wingspan search. I'm not popping the trunk. The trunk is not immediately accessible. If the container is locked, that's not immediately accessible. Okay? That's not within the bounds or the scope of the vehicle frisk. This is your wingspan search. The automobile exception, this is the big one. Okay, this is the plurality of our warrantless vehicle searches occur under the automobile exception, and the rule is simple. You've got probable cause to believe a motor vehicle, an apparent, like what looks to be a functioning motor vehicle, apparently operable, is sometimes used. Probable cause to believe an apparently operable vehicle contains evidence of a crime or contraband, we can search it without a warrant. Now, Carroll, the original automobile exception case, we frequently call it the Carroll Doctrine. This is the true exigency case. This is where the automobile exception was born. Now, this was a search based on true exigency. The mobility of the vehicle, the desolate location, middle of Grand, this is on some highway up in near Grand Rapids, Michigan. The fact that there wasn't time to get a search warrant. They had probable cause, the officers did. The fact that there wasn't time to go obtain a search warrant or wasn't feasible to do that, that was an exigency justifying a warrantless vehicle search. Now, quick note about the automobile exception. There are quite a few states that have limitations or just have no automobile exception. I've listed most of them up here. Some of them are quite restrictive. Pennsylvania, for example, you need an absolute true exigency. New Mexico, same way. Washington, Montana, New Hampshire. There's just no Fourth Amendment. There's no equivalent to the Fourth Amendment automobile exception. A couple of other states that I don't have up here have some slight variations. And not all of these are just no exigency. Some of these are just unoccupied vehicles. Like Connecticut, for example, I think you can't do it on an unoccupied vehicle. Massachusetts talks about impounded vehicles. You need warrants. But otherwise, the automobile exception applies. So what does the automobile exception say? What does the Fourth Amendment automobile exception say? First of all, today, the modern automobile exception, is there an exigency requirement? Do I have to show there was no time to get a search warrant? The answer is absolutely clear, no. That Carroll exigency factor has essentially disappeared from the automobile exception. The court has adopted a second reason, Supreme Court, has adopted a second reason for automobile exception searches. It's no longer that mobility of the vehicle. Yet it's still there. They haven't completely disavowed that prong. It's still there. LeBron and Dyson make this clear. The court says it in the most clear language. There's no exigency requirement. One of these was an unoccupied vehicle. I forget the facts of which one it was, but one of these was an unoccupied vehicle. Nothing exigent about the circumstance. A warrantless vehicle search was permitted on only probable cause. It extends to containers in the vehicle. Ross tells us that the automobile exception, that probable cause to search the vehicle, is probable cause to search all of the containers in the vehicle. It doesn't, as long as the container could house the item I'm looking for, if I'm looking for drugs could be in a backpack, for example. It doesn't matter who owns the vehicle. Who owns the property. Houghton, it was a search because they thought that the guy was in possession of drugs and there's a female in the vehicle. She left her purse. We searched the purse, found drugs in her purse. She said, you had no reason to think that I was involved in illegal activity, and you should have known that was my purse. Okay, and the court says, yeah, we're not going to do that. We're not going to go through trying to figure out whose property these things belong to. We'll need that for proving the crime. But as far as the justification for the search, it's a container. It can house drugs, is what they were looking for in Houghton. It's good to go. It doesn't matter whose property it is. Container's locked. Doesn't matter. Ross says all containers. If I have a locked container and I'm looking for drugs, for example, a safe inside of a car, I can force entry into that safe. I can use reasonable means to open that safe because drugs could be in the vehicle. All containers. No exigency required. No separate search warrant required. The law is clear. So Carney is the case that established the second, officially established the second justification, the primary justification for searching vehicles without warrants under probable cause, and that's the reduced expectation of privacy. Carney says the reason why the automobile exception is additionally justifiable is the fact that there's a reduced expectation of privacy, a significantly reduced expectation of privacy in your vehicle compared to your homes. These are two of my favorite cases. Delayed searches. Again, under the automobile exception. John's. This was a search of a package that was in a vehicle for which they had probable cause to search for drugs. They take the package back to the police station. 3 days later, they get around to searching the package. No real explanation why it took 3 days. But they searched it without a warrant. 3 days later, the Supreme Court said, yep, it's good to go. They could have searched it in the car when they found it that day on the side of the road. 3 days later, doesn't matter. Automobile exception still applies. There's still probable cause to search it. Ross says we can search all containers. We're allowed to take the car and or the container to another location and conduct the search at another time and place without a warrant. The Gaston Barreau is my favorite one. It's a Fourth Circuit case. This was a search that occurred 38 days later. State police in Virginia impound a car. They found drugs in it. They arrested Mr. Gastuburo. They took the car back to the state police barracks. They're intending to begin an asset forfeiture proceeding on the vehicle. Found a whole bunch of drugs in the car. 38 days later, Gastuburo's girlfriend shows up at the state police barracks, coincidentally talks to the same trooper, the one who took the car in the first place. He says, hey, you asked for my boyfriend 38 days ago. I thought he found some drugs in the car. Did you find his heroin and his firearm? See, they found some other kind of drug, wasn't heroin. And his gun. See, he's a felon. He's not allowed to have that. And the trooper's like, yeah, no, I didn't find any heroin. Didn't find a gun. She goes, oh, well, that's because it's behind the radio. You got to pull the radio out of the dashboard. He's got a little compartment back there where he hides that stuff. And so the trooper marches right out there. Doesn't get a warrant. Goes straight out to the car in the lot. Locked, secure lot. Pulls the radio plate. And there it is. There's a gun. And there's a... more drugs. And Gastuburo was like, come on now, 38 days later, there's no reason you couldn't got a search warrant. Fourth Circuit says automobile exception applies. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter how long it's been in custody. They had probable cause. It's a vehicle. They can search it. That's the longest I've seen is 38 days. Residential curtilage. If you're lawfully on the curtilage, you can search the car. Collins did not hold that we can't search cars on driveways. What Collins says, this is an actual photo from the case, it was the motorcycle that was being searched here. What Collins says is we can't go on to curtilage for the sole purpose of searching the car under the automobile exception. See, the automobile exception doesn't allow entry onto the curtilage to search a car. But if you're already on the curtilage, lawfully for whatever reason, and you've got probable cause to search the car, you can search it without a warrant. Even crashed cars, even cars that were recently in crashes, can be searched without a warrant under the automobile exception. This is a Fifth Circuit case, for example, that says that. That's Tiger Woods' car from his second crash, the DUI that he got away with, not the one that his wife hit with a golf club. Arizona versus Gantt. I want to talk about Gantt real quickly in the inventory searches, and we'll wrap it up. Gantt, just not much to say that we haven't already said. Gantt said that vehicle search incident to arrest before Gantt, don't write this down because this isn't the law. We could search cars. You arrest someone out of the car, we could search the car every time. Search incident to arrest. Doesn't matter who we arrested or why we arrested them. We got to do a full search of the passenger compartment of every car that we arrested someone out of as an extension of search incident to arrest. New York versus Belton made that clear. Gantt came along and says, yep, you know what? We didn't really mean that. We went a little far in that case, that Belton case, so we're going to roll that back in. Two reasons now we can search a car incident to arrest. Remember, this is the free search. The arrest is the justification for the search. The arrestee is unsecured or could access the vehicle. Okay, that's probably not going to happen. We're going to have an arrestee secured, locked in the back of the car, that vehicle's not going to be accessible to him. Okay. But the other reason that we can still search vehicles incident to arrest is if you have a reason to believe there is evidence of the crime of arrest in the vehicle. Reason to believe there is evidence of the crime of arrest in the vehicle. So whatever we've arrested this person for, is it reasonable to think that you could find physical evidence of that arrest, that crime, in the passenger compartment of a vehicle? If so, we can search the entire passenger compartment. We're not limited just to where the driver, where the person was sitting. It's the entire passenger compartment. Finally, inventory searches. Yes, they are searches. I don't know why this evokes such debate amongst people. Our officers all the time say, don't call it a search, it's an inventory. No, it's an inventory search. What's the definition of a search? Physical intrusion upon a constitutionally protected area. Intent to gather information. Intrusion upon a reasonable expectation of privacy. You're searching that car, but it's a different kind of search. It's a community caretaking search. Inventory searches are lawful as long as we have two things in place. We have a lawful police order towing of the vehicle. So this vehicle is being towed under police authority. Doesn't have to be taken to our lot. We're ordering it towed away. And the second thing you got to have in order to justify an inventory search is an agency policy, a non-discretionary agency policy that governs inventory searches, that authorizes inventory searches, and also delineates how we're going to conduct these searches. So the court says you got to have a pre-existing agency policy, takes all of the discretion away from the officer. The decision to search the vehicle has already been made. The way, the manner in which we're going to search it has already been made by an administrator. We're going to open lock containers, for example. Are we going to open lock containers? What other parts of the vehicle we're going to look at? What kinds of items we're going to be removing from vehicles? These are the things that should be in your policies. No policy, no inventory search. You can't do an inventory search lawfully without a policy that governs those. All right, my time is up. There's a lot more that I could say, a lot more I'd love to say. But listen, I appreciate everyone's time and attention. Hope you learned something. You got any questions, just holler at me on a break. Thank you, everyone.
Hey guys, check out our upcoming training at StreetCop.com. Don't forget, we have 50 instructors nationally teaching a variety of topics. These are the best classes you're going to experience in your career. We make sure of it. You're going to love it. I guarantee you, you're going to be thankful that you went. Check us out at StreetCop.com for all upcoming classes in your area.